Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hey, that's me. Right on.
Brian?
Yes.
What is going on in the world today?
Man, it depends on what Stephen King put it, what level of the tower. Did you ever read Stephen King's book On Writing?
Yeah, I liked it.
So I was hunting for one passage and I ended up doing a full re-listen of the entire thing. And there's one moment that he really crushes it. He talks about, I'm certain that he planted the seed that kicked around in my brain until just recently I thought of it this way, but I'm dialed in a lot on the game of YouTube and how, when it comes to storytelling, everything from the titles, the thumbnails or whatever, like the viewer, the audience member needs a job. They need a puzzle to crack and they need something to solve on their own. And so as I'm thinking about this, I'm listening to Stephen King's On Writing and he's talking about, is it Annie Wilkes? Is that the name from the character in Misery?
Yeah.
He talks about how he would lose the game. He loses if he has to say she was very moody and depressed and possibly suicidal. Like if he has to tell you, he loses. The way he wins is by describing factually the way she acted in his mind. You know, she did a thing that's congruent with being happy, followed by a thing that was sad or whatever. And then it's up to the audience member to kind of click and have them piece it together. On Writing really, really stands up. It's great.
I used that thinking in Magic, and I don't know if you remember my bowling ball from paper bag effect.
Describe it for the uninitiated.
I have a paper bag. I walk on stage. I flip it around, turn it upside down, and a feather falls out. And then I give it a shake, and a bowling ball falls out. And I had originally created this trick as a thing to do as a demonstration for psychology students, because I wanted to show how indirect evidence could lead you to a conclusion. In this case, you never saw inside the bag, but you were convinced the bag was empty because you literally just handle this bag at your fingertips. It's just extremely lightweight. You spin the bag around, whatever, yet a bowling ball falls out. And I wanted to show how we often think that the thing in front of us is what convinces us, when it's actually all the little other bits of information around it. In this case, just the physics, that the way the bag is handled, there's just physically appears to be no way a bowling ball could be inside there. And that's the idea of a really good magic trick, is it's constructed inside somebody's head. They take a couple pieces of evidence, because otherwise I could just say, have a bag on a table and go, it's empty. I promise you, look, here's a bowling ball. And you'd be like, man, I don't know. I don't trust you. But you use all of your senses to do this. And sometimes senses we're not quite aware of, like we have vision, but also we have a sense of physics, and the trick works by fooling your sense of physics because it just behaves that way. And I think that's with writing. Yeah. It's the difference between showing and telling. You know, telling is she was angry, you know, showing is she walked in the door, threw her keys on the counter and knocked the coffee cup out of his hand.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, ooh, you know, and you feel that. And I think I'll give you one more thing, is that showing works better because saying angry or this are abstractions. We, in the world in which we communicate and we experience stuff, we don't really communicate through abstractions. We can if we're really deeply hypnotic, you know, in a trance, whatever, but if we all of a sudden just throw in all of our own emotions into that. But in the real world, we experience, we see things and we observe things, and that's how we put it together.
I guess also, like, angry is, value judgment aside, angry is a conclusion. And so if you're giving the conclusion, then first of all, people in general, they like to reach their conclusions on their own. They like to be the ones to figure out that she's angry. And likewise, you know, kind of like the toddler, you have to make it their idea to
Within limits. If you make them work, the work has to be worth the payoff. If you make them work too hard for it and the payoff is not that worth it, then they're not happy. But if there's a little bit of work and the reward is outside to that, if I do this really, because sometimes people try to be too clever. They write these novels with all these twists and turns. Aha, and they see it was the color red. And they're like, I don't care. I had to do so much work to get to this. It doesn't matter anymore. So that's the other key. I think it's an important thing, is I can make an audience, and some audiences, and people who really like mysteries like to work more than people who like thrillers.
Yes.
And that's a thing. And people who like thrillers like to work more than people who like romance novels. If you read, if you go read, you know, Twilight, there's no work there. It's literally, or that those genre novels, there's no work there because at that age, you know, when you're the audience there, they just want to know, am I angry? Am I sad? Am I this? And so that often condition very much varies upon the audience. And that's why I, as a writer, try to avoid, don't be too clever, because I'll get 10% that'll appreciate it. And the 90% will get lost and be upset and be like, why, what was the point?
Well, and I think about it in terms of, I wonder if this is factually true, but I think about it just in terms of calories. Like there's somebody who had a good YouTube video, but was asking me for help on the title. I was like, okay, well, your video does have a title that links, like, the things that you say on here do pay off in the video. However, remember that part of your job is to make it easy and frictionless is the word that pops into my mind so that the viewer spends as few calories as possible crossing that threshold. And so the way it was right now, it's like, this is this and that, do that. And it's like, okay, if you want to make it easy to click on, then figure out what their role is. For example, right now, The Week in Bleeding Edge, Weird Science with Andrew Main is what I titled this one. It is pretty clear to anybody hovering over this very live stream that we're doing right now that when they come in, they will know their role. Their role is they're going to walk in the middle of a discussion, hopefully with that guy from Modern Road, Brian Brushwood, and also that guy, Andrew Main, that's in the title. And sure enough, we have achieved congruence so that people don't instantly like, what is this? And then turn it off.
Yeah. I look at like what the promise is, and I had a YouTube video the other day that I just watched, and it was like, mind blowing theories about like Godfather or something. And they were stupid. And so I'm like, root for my history, unliked. And like, cause I'm like, no, like you didn't give me any mind blowing. You gave me some very dumb things. You know? And if it was like, hey, dumb theories about Godfather, I'd be like, well, okay, that's the promise. And I'm like, oh, okay. I'd be upset for it. But like, that was my way of telling the other creator, like, listen, like if you're using clickbaity things to get me to watch, not only will I not subscribe, I'm going to dislike it and also remove it from my watch history, so I don't get anything more from you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's the thing too. It's hard because like, you know, we know that like there's people reduce things to things like engagement. We just need engagement. And it's like, no, I need engagement. I need trust. I need follow through. I want to build an audience. And that's the difference between somebody can create. There are people like, I made a thing that goes viral. Like, cool. Did the next thing you released get anywhere near that or not? Because if you don't have an audience that's waiting for your next thing, you have to work really hard to try to come up with the next thing. You know, what's your baseline?
Yeah, there's a little bit to remember in terms of two vectors. One is timeline. Like, for example, you can have something catch like wildfire, but it'll flame out and ultimately it changed nothing. It did nothing, right? And also it left people less likely to give this kind of thing a chance a second time. So your timeline for when do you want the payoff, whether it's in, you know, let's say you're trying to get a movement that you need people to vote a certain ways, then you don't want to just have everyone feel good and shout on Twitter because now they've tickled all their dopamine and they didn't hold on to anything long enough to get to the part where they have to actually vote at the polls. But then the other thing is, I took too long to get to. I'm sure it'll pop into my head later. But
yeah, I go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, no. That's all I got.
Yeah. I think that, you know, I think that there's certain building audience is important. There is engagement, audience. Engagement doesn't always equal audience. Audience is the people that are going to come show up and see you time after time.
Oh, I did. It did come back. You mentioned engagement, which made me think of how the word engagement is a low fidelity communication vector. Like,
yes,
it is easy to measure. And in the world of marketing, the legendary marketer Roy Williams talks about twitchy little bastards. They spend, all they want to know is what's your quarterly ad revenue stuff. And then they'll figure out a way so that technically the biggest numbers can be flashed in your face. All of it losing sight of the real goal, which is get people to hire you to fix their AC or whatever. And that dance is a dance of trust over the long term and building a deep relationship so that when an emergency happens, the availability heuristic, the person you trust the most because you've been listening to, whether it be a feel-good founder's message or funny skits that they do on the morning commute over and over and over, then you become the go-to action. Whereas twitchy bastards are going to be using those low fidelity, technically right words, which, by the way, of all the ways to be right, the worst is technically right. Technically, they did get your message in front of 100,000 people with that billboard, but nobody cared more about it than you driving by. Nobody is weeping at the thought of it the way an extremely good long distance commercial would in the 1980s. Brown Coat TBH said, so it's the tango. I think that is, as I understand it, the kind of push-pull, that seduction in storytelling.
Yeah, there's also, it's a difference between an idea and a brand. You know, I like this idea, I don't care about the brand, you know, and you saw that happen now, like with Marvel, where Marvel had a lot of great ideas, but built a great brand. And then now I like Thunderbolts, you know, I'm not so into the other stuff and this and that. And then, you know, and so now Thunderbolts I thought was great, but because the brand, the reputation, the brand had declined so much, it had terrible box office, which is a pity because, and that, you know, Fantastic Four, which I think I've only seen it once, but Fantastic Four is really fun. These were movies that would have done $1 billion each 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And now the reputation's now like, well, I'll see, you know, I'll see if I like it. And it's now they're into like trying to go for more zeitgeisty stuff, but we'll see. Speaking of media, Brian.
Yeah.
It's been 1 week since we last spoke about it. Do you remember Sora? Do you remember Sora at all?
R.I.P. Sora. It came, it went. Nobody knows what happens. It was like a daydream fluttering in our surrealist minds.
Or is it? Let me check my daily usage for Sora.
I think I've maintained a healthy amount of dreaming. Oh, here's the thing that I realized. A friend of mine, he put his finger exactly on it. He loves goofing around on Sora, hates seeing it in his Facebook feed. And what it reminded me of is somebody once said, nobody wants to hear about your dreams or your LSD trips. And I feel like that same sentiment, like within the app where it's nothing but shared daydreams, it's an astonishing, because it's non, what, discursive? Am I using it right? It's not, you're not saying anything out loud. You're just sort of living pictures and vibes. On the one hand, it's a terrible communication modality because it doesn't, it's like interpretive dance. If there was a forest fire, I would not press the mass interpretive dance alert button to let people know to evacuate, because that would be very difficult to get that information across. However, if I was going through a breakup and I wanted somebody to understand what I was feeling, then interpretive dance maybe becomes more useful than a bunch of words.
Brian, I'm lost on that one.
What? I'm talking about communication outside of Broca's area. Broca's area, non-linguistic communication.
For a guy who loves communication, sometimes I feel like there's so many layers to this.
There is. Well,
I'm up to 21 minutes a day on Sora. I think I fell from last week, but I'm still doing 21 minutes a day or so.
What are you noticing in the Soras?
I don't miss, I mean, I'm sure having the trademark characters and stuff in there certainly added another fun thing to make fun of, but I'm having a lot of fun with it. Watching stuff, like we created a dumb thing, which was called Handfuls, which is the fast food restaurant that pours gravy right into your hands. And that's had like 50 remixes now.
It is. And it is great to have a thought and an idea that catches fire. It is awesome. Let me see if I can find the handful of stuff for you.
Yeah. So I shared a video of somebody who I like, but I don't want to name them by name, but they're a very famous YouTuber who is just ranting against Sora. Like it was a get off my lawn, you kids rant. And
was it based on the content that's created or environment or copyright or which flavor of frustration was it?
I posted the video in a Slack with you or in a channel with you and me and Justin. And it is basically like, they just call it tick slop. They're like, it's a slop. It's this. And you also feel like this feels like a creator who's been around for over a decade, who feels like they don't like the idea that there's another thing competing for attention. And it was very interesting because we like it because we're putting each other in this stuff. You know, we put our friends and stuff in there. We have a group joke. We get to make the joke. Other people sometimes like the joke. They take on the joke and they do the joke. And I think other people look at it like, it's just a stream of AI content. I'm like, well, dude, you're using it wrong then. I have this sort of theory that a lot of people's takes about AI are based upon how introverted they are and how, antisocial they are. Like the people who I have that AI is going to take over everything are the most antisocial people I know because they don't understand the value of working with people. They people are a nuisance to get in the way of it. And so when they fantasize about the future, that's like, what if I don't have to deal with people? It's like, okay.
Unpack a little bit of that for me. Let me hear more about that.
So whenever I get engagement online with the idea that AI is going to replace everything, and this little anecdotal probing, these people tend to have the most antisocial takes. These are people that just don't have patience for other people. These are people who are kind of like, I'll give you an example. There was an organization, I don't want to name it by name, but let's say it was a genre. They like science fiction, fantasy stuff in LA. And I used to go there, right? And it was kind of fun because they had a big library. It was really cool. But it's room full of people just sitting there reading books, maybe playing a game, not eye contact, very little discussion, right? Most introverted kind of people you could imagine. I would every now and then show up and I'd bring a bunch of pizzas. I'd go set the pizzas on the counter. And like zombies, they'd come in, eat the pieces, grab the pizza, and then go off to their corner. Nobody said hello or thank you or anything. It's fine. And then they went off into their own little space because the pizzas just appeared. In their world, the pizzas were just there. Just somebody made pizzas appear, and that was their engagement. This is a place they went to because, it's kind of like you go to Barnes & Noble and you have to step over the kids reading the graphic novels and stuff who don't even see you. And so there are certain people who are extremely introverted and stuff, and they don't even know how things work in the world or how things happen. And so you sometimes see that where, very online people who are very antisocial, but they might really like this manga, which is put out by a team of people that's working together for 20 years and not aware that, those four or five Japanese artists have been getting together for 20 years to map out these stories. And it's a whole house that does this stuff. And they have this idea that, things just appear. They're just things in the world. And they don't realize how much of things are created by people working with other people who value what other people do. And so when I get the kind of I believe that AI will be it will pass an IQ test higher than a human, that will be physically stronger than a human, will last longer than a human and all that. But for many of us, if we decided to, if Brian, I said, hey, our company should talk and you showed up and I wasn't there and it was just my robot, you'd be pretty pissed.
Yeah.
Because you're like, you're not, because another form of currency is time.
Yes.
Money's currency. Time is currency. And when I get, one of the reasons why book signings have value is that authors showed up and made time for me. I got to spend 4 minutes telling William Gibson how awesome he is. And he listened to me. That you can't, it's like, well, we figured out when we put an economic value of that, when we do fan meetups at comic cons and stuff, people pay hundreds of dollars to meet with these people for the time. And so we know that humans have an incredible, put a high value on this stuff. And that's why it's funny. I watched Pauly Shore was on a recent episode of Kill Tony, and he was just at one of these like fan meetup things. And he's like, oh, you're at this thing. Tony was sort of alluding. He's like, yeah, there's a tradition of giving back to go do this and all this. And I'm like, oh, so you didn't get paid to go show up and do this? Like, you did this for free, or you were paid? That's fine. That's totally fine. But if you need to frame it like I'm doing this thing to give back to people, come on. You don't have to do that. You can say my time is worth money and I'll show up for fans for this.
Well, I think that that's part of the general anxiety about AI is specifically, for example, a feeling that might be familiar is a brief moment that you believe that a personal email or physical bit of mail was sent to you by somebody very important. And then you figure out that, oh, their assistant did this.
Brian Brushwood wants to tell me about something new and cool.
Well, first of all, that is actually me. I have for years gone out of my way to make it pretty freaking clear.
You respond to people.
Yeah.
I'm just teasing you.
But
Brian, if you write to Brian back, Brian is highly, highly, highly engaged. It is not a machine, but I was.
That is true. But I think that the general anxiety of just being on edge of like, nobody wants to, let's say you're at Chuck E. Cheese and out of respect, one of the robots bow to you and then you bow back and then somebody laughs at you, you know, like those moments, like we don't want to be alone and we don't want to be the sucker. And AI has suddenly made it very hard. So all of us are spending, in general, a few more calories than we'd like being on guard against those things. And so as a result, I think that the person who did the YouTube screed, I try to have grace. I'm like, oh, bless their hearts. They're just scared. But here's an example that popped out of my mouth the other day. Is part of the reason I don't worry about things is a thing that nobody said was, why on earth would I pay some guy with a guitar that's probably not as perfectly in tune as the world's best guitar when I could just play a compact disc at my wedding of the world's greatest orchestra? Why on earth would I possibly pay for a guitarist? Like, that's a conversation that doesn't happen. That's not a thing. And it's like, why on earth would I pay and tip a human to serve me at this restaurant dinner when I could have the world's most attentive robot? That is also, well, there will be a brief moment that somebody says that, and then they're going to get real lonely real fast.
Yeah, I had an article that I was working on titled, like, how much compute does it take to replace Taylor Swift? And the point I was making was, you can watch your concert in 8K with higher quality audio, with better visuals than it is, a better audio and visual experience in theory than going to see her in person. Yet it's a $1 billion tour. People have literally gone into credit card debt to go see her in person. And that's when I get this whole AI does everything. I'm like, well, we'll have AI pop. Okay. You'll have an AI pop star and you run into the Blue Man Group problem. The Blue Man Group is great because you can have multiple Blue Man Group, but there's no longer a Blue Man Group. So you go see Blue Man Group. It's any Blue Man Group. You know, I can have, you get these bands that syndicate themselves and like, you know, like that have different versions of them, touring versions. You have to go, I want to go see the original. There's reasons why we like original and canonical and things like this. And so you're not saying you couldn't have robot Taylor Swift, and you might have it where it plays the other markets. But if you're saying the fact that I can have a robot do this is the same, we will be okay with that. Humans have never been okay with that. We literally launched the Crusades and created wars over holy relics because we want the special one, true one. And I get these people like, well, no, we're all going to be hyper-rationalist. Like, that doesn't happen.
Yeah,
and
also, well, think about this. Here's a whole industry for you. Antiques. Why? Yeah. Why?
Yes.
But this is actually Hitler's bong. Like, no, it's just like, why would that matter? I can make an even better Hitler's bong.
I knew somebody who's roommates with Marilyn Manson. You know Rudy. Rudy was. Rudy,
oh, yeah. Coger, yeah.
Buddy Rudy. And he said Marilyn had Hitler's coat hanger.
And I'm certain that what mattered was not the authentic coat hangerness, but the authentic Hitlerness.
Probably, unfortunately. So I was there with somebody and one of these was dancers there goes, why would he have that? And I said, because he really hates wrinkles.
I think that we're looping back on, I think that many of the things that we predicted, man, 15 years ago on this very program, we talked about like in the future, isn't it wild? We'll be able to say, have my robot agent contact your robot agent. And then that's today.
But I also just want to touch more too on like the concept of where value comes from is Manhattan real estate without Central Park, not as valuable, right?
Yeah.
And if you say, well, hey, what's the value of all this internet fiber? You know, well, what's the number one use of internet after 6 p.m.? Netflix. So what's the value of this without Squid Games? You know, and you have to start to say, these are things that are valuable to other people and people often. And Sora, to me, what I thought the real big lesson from Sora was the most valuable and most entertaining things on there are often the things where my friends are doing stuff. And I find that my friends doing a stupid skit is way more valuable to me than something really well polished. And I think that's the takeaway that I wish people would stop and say, oh, it's not just the AI thing. The Cameo function was two things. One, independence. My really creative friends who have jobs and don't have time to spend around creating skits all day can now come up with a really funny idea and make me laugh out loud. I've never laughed out loud more than Sora. Two, I can do stuff with my friends. And we've talked about this before, doing things out of sequence and stuff. I can say, hey, Brian, you, me, and Justin, I'm going to make a thing. I'm just going to take your personas and throw them into a little skit. And now we have a funny thing we can share. And that's the temporal, the idea that it doesn't have to be done, it's amazing.
Well, and also it can be, we've talked a bit about how it feels like a writer's room. If you've ever been in a writer's room where everybody's riffing and plussing up other folks' ideas, it's like an HD version of that. But it also reminds me a bit of action figures. I mean, that's what's the most fun is playing with your friends and just imagining the places you'll go. And that's the funny part is the actual visual artifacts are incidental. The exciting part is we like to say it's the thought that counts. It literally is the thought that is counting. Like when it says somebody made a thing of you and Andrew Main, then I'm just like, oh my God, somebody somewhere imagined a moment with the two of us. What do they imagine? And then iterate enough that they hit approve. There's a lot of things it's not. And a lot of the things that people are arguing about are things that it's not, but what it is strange. It's unlike anything else I've seen. So as an example, you had a thought of handfuls, a place where they ladle gravy right into your hands. Here, let me see if I can get audio going on this. Here we go.
Way.
We just pour our slow simmered gravy straight into the best container you own, your hands.
It's so smooth.
At Handful.
So when you see this, what pops into the mind of a Sora user is not, oh, clever computers. Aren't computers great? No. The first thing you do is you look and you're like, Andrew Main thought this was a funny idea. Do I feel like it's funny enough to comment upon or hit that beautiful, beautiful remix button? And so how do I get to the remixes of it in desktop?
Did clicking on the remix thing up in the upper right?
Well, I guess I can, but that has me writing a remix.
Oh, it doesn't let you scroll. I'm sorry. So you don't have it doesn't have the scroll
on the desktop. Function. Oh, that's a bummer. No, remixes. They're right here. Here we go. So then now we can move on to the next one.
Even have to leave your car.
Ooh, straight from the window.
Our drive-thru is open and we're pouring slow simmered gravy right into the best container you own, your hands.
It feels...
At Handfuls, you don't even have to leave your car.
So again, I'm instantly dialed in on who? The human who had a thought to beef up your thought. And so now I'm watching a game. And of course, you know, two is a scene, and our now I want to jump in.
Pouring slow simmered gravy right into the best container.
And so that's
your
where
hands.
We get
at Handfuls. You don't even.
There we go.
Your car.
Oh, it's see through.
Our drive through is open, and we're pouring slow simmered crystal gravy
somebody
right into the best container.
Gravy.
You at Handfuls. You don't even have to leave your car.
Ooh, it's golden.
Our drive through is serving the new golden gravy.
So if you pause for a second, I'll tell you right a couple things I appreciated was. my prompt was a fast food chain where they just pour gravy into your hands, right?
Oh, so it came, Sora up, with,
came up
with handfuls.
It came with the name handfuls and the best container you have, your hands. It came up with all of that. And so the whole, is AI funny? I'm sorry. I have laughed out loud from just simple prompts that it's come up with. They're like, well, you came with a premise. Like, sure, but I could probably come up with a premise generator and have it do this. Like, this is this. Some of these things are, I've laughed out loud more than I have on an SNL sketch for a long time. And I think that scares a lot of people, is because it got scary good. And so that would say, and then people come with these great remixes.
Well, and I do suspect that it would be less funny if I was alone watching all of these thrown at me, and I didn't perceive that there was a thinking human, much less a thinking human that I know, is what makes it funny.
At Handfuls, the buffet is all about the gravy.
Oh, that gold is shiny.
Dip in for golden, classics. Handfuls goes digital. Our new video game lets you sling crystal gravy like a pro.
Got it. Look at that pour.
Fill every lane, stack those.
Handfuls will meet you at the door now.
You're pouring it right here?
Yep. Our new delivery brings slow simmer gravy straight to your hand.
Handfuls will meet you at the door now.
You're pouring it right here?
Yep. And for the holidays, we're bringing the whole pot.
Handfuls will meet you at the door now.
You're pouring it right here?
Yep.
Meet the Handfuls Junior Gravy Playset. Made for young...
I can't believe this is on record.
Go ahead. Tell it.
All right. So when we first dreamed up Handfuls, it wasn't gravy. It was, let's just say, a much more adult concept. We had napkin sketches.
Oh, my God.
What wall? I bring the good stuff straight to your hands.
You're really a bowl?
A giant bowl of gravy. Hold them out.
Whoa. It's hot.
Wall? What wall? The good gravy comes.
So anyway, that's it's remarkable. And it's because of the humans that are jumping into it that makes it fun. It's there's this. I think we talked last week about the Steven Pinker book. When everybody knows that everybody knows, this consensus moment where private knowledge becomes common knowledge, like each successive remix running with it is taking the private knowledge that somebody finds this funny and making it common knowledge. Like now we know that Tom thought it was funny. We know, you know, at first we knew that Andrew thought this was funny. Then we knew that that Justin thought Andrew's idea was funny and Andrew knows it. And.
Yeah, it's, I think the problem is, and I've said this before, I'm kind of a broken record on this, but people get very hung up on old mediums and new media and trying to put new media into old mediums. And the new medium here is a platform where my friends and I can make jokes about each other, put each other into videos and tell stuff and share them with other people, and other people can go viral. But the real value is my friends and I get to collaborate and do this. Other people go, oh, it's just a bunch of TikTok videos. And it's like, all right, dude.
Well, and here's another comp is think about the high-end DJ, your Deadmau5 and out there. Like I don't get it. Someone just comes up and hits play on an iPod. That's it. Yes, but of course, whatever that experience is, it's because of the consensus of all the other humans there. And the fact that whether it's the specific person or the brand identity of, you know, DJ, whoever, But somebody is accepting responsibility to take it all through. By the way, shouts out to all the folks in the chat. Thank you very much, Sam Beb, Robert O'Brien, Matt Hawley. It's good to see you guys. Dylan Theus, of course. Matt Hawley says, reminds me of Vines. I think that that's another very good comp because it was questionable. Everyone was like, how is this even art? It's 6 seconds. It's so low effort. It can't possibly be a thing. And then Vines went away and we all howled and the internet died a little.
Well, and the problem with Vines, in my opinion, was that was the 6 second. There was an upper limit to how much you can do. And already Sora now you can do on the app, you can do 15 seconds. They went from 10 to 15 seconds now. And then on the web version, you can do storyboards. And so you can do much longer videos.
I didn't mean to interrupt, but I was going to say that I'm looking forward to them. Whether it is a culturally emergent phrase that works with it, whatever it takes, I'm ready for the ability to go to the next scene. Cause oftentimes the remix is the bulk of the remixed video is the same. And it's like, no, 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 we want to continue it and go on to the next scene, which I've had mixed results on just saying the scene continues.
Yeah. So there are two things that are kind of coming together right now. And the Sora team, some of my friends are now on it. They're working fast on this. And so part of it is they were able to kind of extend the video model to do 15 seconds, which is kind of pretty cool. The other thing is storyboard mode, where you can take inputs from the previous video and go into the next one. So if you're cutting between shots, you can do that. So I expect us to see really fast iteration on that. As far as, you know, and talking about some of the implementations that can come into place to make this like extremely usable. So unlike Vines, they should have let Vines go up to a minute. If Vines had said, oh, let's let a minute, because I think you could do a ton of content in a minute, that would have been a great form for that. But, you know, Twitter back then, they were just weird. And I think it had Vines let you do like a minute engagement, could have been an entire ecosystem here. I don't know. They need to set an upper limit, but I like the idea they're continuing to do that, because I could just watch educational stuff in here. If you know, Brian or somebody like said, oh yeah, I'm going to do a channel that's like legit educational stuff. Hell yeah. I would watch that.
There was a few of them before I got distracted by something else shiny. I was having Sesame Street style puppets explain arbitrage and explain, you know, all these economic theories. Diggy in the chat points out that a limitation that I'm sure is being worked on right now is that it's not so great at having the same character in another scene. But that's something I've heard for a while is something that's being fixed.
Yeah, and again, the Sora can take video and image inputs. The way Sora works right now is it takes your little video that you made in your audio sample and it uses that as an input. And so you can use that to continue to extend. So it's going to move very, very fast. And Pro, if you get a chance to play a Sora 2 Pro, really high quality. I've shown you some demonstrations of that before, like really, really high quality. So the space is going to get good very quickly a year from now, you know, making, you know, people would be able to make their own half hour animes in this or VO4 or whatever's coming next.
Yeah.
The question's going to be is I think the difference between professional creators and amateurs is going to stand. Somebody just does it, a hobbyist, and somebody who takes it seriously will become very apparent. And I'm excited because, you know, now, you know, somebody, a couple people, the vision could create an entire anime.
I want to engage in just a little bit of copyright violation to make an important salient point. Can you cover for 10 seconds?
Well, Brian, as I have said before, any such violations are the responsibility of one Brian Brushwood who lives in Texas.
All right. So here we go.
Mixmaster Mike, so are you ready?
Let's think about, I mentioned a lot of remix culture stuff where early days of hip hop, you had folks playing music and then rapping over it, right? And it was not clear whether or not rap was art, whether or not it was transformative and met all of the legal definitions or whatever. And then record scratching was a novel thing where it's like, in general, it would be a loop. And then you just hear a little bit of a record scratch and it's like, that's just noise. But at some point it does become something different, and there's not going to be an obvious moment that it happens, but this is, here's Mixmaster Mike. So that's a copyrighted. Like 20 years before that was recorded, how would you even find the words to describe what that is? And that's where we're at now. We don't yet have the vocabulary to explain what somebody who makes AI things are. And so I don't know. All that is to say, I don't blame people getting wound up over it, but I'm here with my popcorn out watching fire get invented.
Yeah, it's, you know, as a It's a person who writes, does, you know, is involved creatively, makes a living as a, both a novelist and someone involved in AI. You know, I often kind of, you know, get asked or sort of say like, well, what do you think about this? And it's like, you know, I'm a person that I have a writing career because I read a bunch of books and learned on how to write from that. And I found styles that influenced me. And, you know, I've been a believer that, like, I like the idea of owning the copyright to the entire work, but I have no problem with people taking pieces of my work or being inspired by my work. You know, if, you know, I found out that somewhere at Lucasfilm, there was a writer's room and my book was one of 20 books on a table that they're taking inspiration from. We're like, oh, okay.
If you were part of Taika Waititi's vibe board for some new project, that wouldn't bother you.
Yeah. No, not at all. I mean, if it was this book, we're going to copy this, whatever, I'd be like, all right. But again, they can do that. I'd be like, you know, probably easier just to talk to me. But, and I have had that happen where I've had projects that were out, and I'm not the guy to go, oh, I got robbed, but I've had like literally agents go like, yeah,
for the record, we'll let everyone inside the gossip tent. That is a real thing that happened when I was pitching Hacking the System, what became Hacking the System. True TV had passed on it. And then they called me, not realizing that I was the one that they called me to be an expert on their knockoff version of it. So that does happen.
Yeah, you get it happens if you're kind of a nobody, you know, they'll say we like it, but we just don't want to have to deal with the IP or we're going to change it or sometimes. But I've had like properties that were out there that were extremely unique in their own thing. And then something else came up that like, you know, I've had like my agent go, yeah, because I've never the one guy. Oh, because I know so many people say, oh, I was copied. I'm like, dude, that was the most basic idea that's been out there forever. And so a lot of times, anytime somebody sees them remotely copy, create clover, look closest, but I'd be like, yeah, no, they went in and just said, they just wanted to work around it. But my point is saying like, you know, if it's too derivative, it's too derivative, but you where that line is, everybody has to draw their own line on it. For me, for machine learning stuff like this, you know, it one, these things don't remember the entirety of the text, whatever, and they learn from it. I've never had a problem with that. I just don't.
Well, and I wonder like, when they say these things are trained on things, a solution would be, well, let's say Nintendo, they want to say, none of our stuff, or let's say Disney, they're like, don't train on any of our stuff at all. What that means is that it cannot conceive of the joke. It cannot get the joke, or get the reference or get the lesson. And, I don't know, short term.
What gets it, but you get into this thing where it's like, you know, part of the problem we've had too, is that like authors were like, this was trained on my books. And I know direct knowledge of anybody, of what was being done or whatever, but I know that we have book summaries everywhere of stuff. And the summary isn't present that it did that, but also knowing the plot of your book isn't the same as it, you know, printing out a copy of your book on demand, you know, and you get into these weird things of where, you know, you could say, okay, I could stand outside the movie theater after a movie and talk to people and get the entire plot for the movie.
Well, and to be honest, there are many movies that I cannot be bothered to spend 2 hours watching. However, I have deeply enjoyed 2 hour explainer recaps from Kevin Smith of the, I will listen to a Kevin Smith summary of a movie exactly as long as the movie any day of the week.
Yeah. I would probably be more willing to listen to Kevin Smith talk about the movie he made than watch the movie he made.
That is true. No, that's his work. Although I will vouch for Red State. I enjoyed that quite a bit, but his work is hit and miss.
But he's also this incredible storyteller when he's just put on stage with a microphone. I think the point is as we move into this sort of remix culture, and I say the cool thing about Sora was that like memes is like, you know, memes are out there. You can't control memes or whatever. And I think there's an opportunity for OpenAI to work with people who say, hey, I will explicitly allow my works and give, you know, for people to do this under these conditions, whatever, and to figure something out. But it doesn't need it. It's the thing. Like I'm realizing more like it doesn't need those works, which I think people in Hollywood have to think about.
Yeah. Yeah. The What else? What other news is going on? Did SpaceX do a rocket?
Did they do a rocket? I think they did a rocket. Let's go see if SpaceX did a rocket.
I think they did one earlier this week, and I think that it cleared all of the big milestones that they were hoping for, if I remember correctly. And they showed video of the first stage looking tantalizingly close to almost making a civilized landing in the water.
Yeah, they did a hover. Yeah, that's pretty cool. So they did a hover before landing.
I guess I could.
This was from October 12th.
Yeah, that's right.
It's moving fast. It's amazing. And you know, another company that's been doing kind of great has been Rocket Lab.
Tell me more.
Rocket Lab is, they've been launching satellites with a regular cadence. They've been taking on, more clients. And they're working on their fully reusable rocket too. Wow, that's so cool. We're looking at the Starship, the upper stage, come down and do a hover and then land in the water.
Yeah, that was...
Man, that thing looks gnarly. That looks like Star 11. Wars level.
It really does. It is very weathered and lived in. And the money shot, it really looks almost like it could just land. Although, I guess we already saw it do the chopstick on the top stage. And I guess I missed when they switched to calling it Mars. Starship Mars.
Never heard that.
Let me double check it. Are they calling that ship Mars? Question mark. Then we'll get an explanation. No. Oh, got it. So I wonder where I read that. It doesn't matter.
So another one to watch is going to be, there's Blue Origin, of course, Jeff Bezos, and then you have Rocket Lab, which is building, they're working on the Neutron rocket.
Rocket Lab, what is the Neutron rocket?
That'll be their fully reusable rocket.
I heard about a policy change. NASA, is it the SLS that they weren't going to use something on? They were going to use it as a payload on another service?
Yeah, the Orion. The Orion rocket, with the Orion capsule, which I watched the first test launch of that, they're considering putting that on top of other things besides the SLS, because one, the SLS is just stupidly expensive to put that up there.
Yeah. Neutron Rocket Lab. Yeah. That's interesting. How far off does Rocket Lab appear to be?
With that, I don't know, but they've been doing, I think they've done like 15 launches this year or something with their other stuff. So, they're quietly there. Their stock has gone up considerably.
Oh, so they're publicly traded. Let's see. Look at that. Yeah, they got a test burn.
Yes. If you compare this to the video on Flight 10's landing, neither the flames or venting are visible. It's thought that because of the missing tires.
God, that's really amazing. That's just extraordinary.
Some burn through in the spots leading to venting.
And I guess in theory, those engines could just fire like that in perpetuity.
You mean like reusable, or what's the question?
Well, like the way we used to think of solid rocket boosters is they get real hot and then they're no good for anything anymore. But as we're watching this burn goes for the entire duration of a flight. And I'm wondering, in theory, if you had enough fuel, could they just keep on burning?
Yeah. So with the liquid, part of it depends. So a lot of it is the cooling system around there. I think that's the one of the measures of success is how long you do your burn for. Because when you're trying to do, let's say, a Mars burn, you know, what you do is you put your rocket up in orbit, then you refill it with the tankers, so you get a full up tank load, and then you're going to be doing a burn that lasts for a long period of time. So obviously, so yeah, that's a metrics of how quality an engine is, how long it can sustain being that hot for.
Yeah.
Where that was the problem with solid rocket boosters is they're burned, and sometimes you can reuse thrusters. It was just such a dumb way to sort of do it, in my opinion.
I mean, again, you at the time, I don't want to fault anyone. Reminder, it was a miracle we made it to the moon.
No, but we those were in theory reusable boosters, though. Remember the space shuttle, the solid rocket boosters on the shuttle were the ones on the side. Those were literally just cylinders with like basically burnt tire and oxidizer inside of them.
Mm-hmm.
Where the there was a plan to reuse the Saturn V boosters because those things weren't solid rocket boosters. Those were liquid, and you know, you could in theory do enough parachutes or whatever on them and let them fall down the ocean and retrieve them. So, you know, there was plans for reusability going back to the 50s. Reusability was always in the cards. And then the shuttle originally was going to be entirely reusable. But then, you know, one thing after another, they then abandoned the reusability. And then they said, well, we'll just use these. Because they also looked at, like, it's government contracting. Like, well, we're going to spend $1 billion to launch a thing. Well, that wasn't how much they pitched it initially. But they're like, we can build these boosters. And the boosters were supposed to be reusable, too. Because they could just... But again, it's like, great, you're going to pull these things out of the ocean, try to hammer them back straight, whatever, and do that. And it was reusable in the dumbest sort of sense. Like, anything that you just drop into the ocean and you call reusable is like, kind of reusable.
Right. You know? Yeah. No, it was definitely, it was not great. Did you see anything good? You got any picks this week?
My picks are... We've continued to watch Daredevil season 2, and man, it's a great show. There was we got to, spoiler alert, there's a point where the Punisher goes to jail, and then there's stuff that happens, and you just look at the quality of what was there. Like, if this was on today, everybody would be talking about it. Like, Daredevil season 2, it's a fantastic season of television.
Yeah.
It's like The Wire for, like, comic book fans.
It makes me, you know what? I can see that. I still need, I've had to hold off on watching Daredevil because my daughter Penny went back to college, but now she gets back today. So maybe I'll jump on that tonight.
Yeah. Cause with Roshni and I, we were working our way through it before we got to watching Born Again.
Mm-hmm. I got a weird pick for you. We're covering it over on the Cord Killers podcast. The original 1966, there was only one season of it, but the original Speed Racer, Mach Go Go Go, as it was known in Japan. It's fascinating.
Chim, 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 may, may, all that.
Yeah. I mean, that part, my patience wore thin pretty quick as the loud screaming noise and kind of staccato fight scenes, they took up about a third of it. But the stuff that I'm there's a moment where you see, you know, you've seen the opening credit sequence where you have Speed Amazing. Jumping out of the Mach, and it does the bullet time thing. 1966 by hand, they're doing the bullet time 3D rotation and stuff. That stuff was really, really cool.
Yeah. I very much thought it was a fun show, you know, great, catchy. There was just some amazing stuff going on in, you know, Japanese animation.
Yeah. So
it just, I feel like, you know, whoever this Racer X guy is, I hope we figure it out. Sorry, it's Trixie. Sorry, that was who. But yeah, I remember when we heard, like, you know, the Wachowskis were going to go do, you know, make the film, and then they're like, cool. Then they're like, oh,
Yeah, I never watched it. It never made it past the threshold of me giving it my full attention.
In 2022, Apple TV Plus announced that a live-action television series from J.J. Abrams is in development with this company, Bad Robot. Based on an unproduced script that he'd written in 1990s. Well, that was three years ago.
Speed Racer?
Yeah, Speed Racer.
Yeah. Well, watch the original. It's available on Amazon Prime. I was able to talk to, I said, hey, A word, not that A word, the other A word. I said, show me Speed Racer, season one, episode one. And then boom, it did. It was great.
Sweet. It's been weird.